This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. This week, the Chinese President Xi Jinping says that China needs to assert itself more effectively on the world stage and become more credible, lovable, and respectable. His speech came ahead of the G7 summit next weekend, where the rise of China is becoming an increasingly fraught subject for Western nations. This week, there have been some striking developments when it comes to China and its relationship with the West, and these stories are going to have profound implications for the rest of the world. I'm John Connolly, and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Cindy Yu, who have both written about China in this week's magazine. Now, Cindy, to start off, you've written this week about what was the one-child policy, and which has now this week become the three-child policy for the magazine. And as you write, your family has quite a big sort of personal relationship, or, you know, quite an intense relationship with the one-child policy. Can you tell us a bit about that to start us off?
Yeah, of course. So I think without the one-child policy, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. And the reason for that is because my brother was my mum's second child, and when she was pregnant with him, she was reported on by a neighbour about the second pregnancy. They gave her a choice. Either you go to the abortion clinic by yourself or we'll take you there. It wasn't very, you know, not a very real choice. But fortunately for her, her husband, my father, was already in London working here. So we made a third decision, which was just to all migrate. And I didn't understand this at the time because I was quite young, but 6 months pregnant, she took me and we came to London. So for her, it's a very, something I didn't put in the piece, which is that she shared on a family group, fuming that this is too late, this three-child policy that's come in this week, because hundreds of millions of women have missed out on family lives that they could have had. But the Chinese government has pretty much U-turned. I mean, it raises a question about why have a cap at all. Most people don't have more than three children today anyway, but they just can't really admit that it is a U-turn. And it just betrays this deeper vulnerability and sensitivity about China's aging population. And it's predicted that by the end of this decade, China's population will start to decline. And that's a trend that's happening across the world. So not necessarily that special, but for China, creates all sorts of unique problems, not least in the fact that because it's so labor-driven, if you have fewer people, your economy may very well stutter. And so there are incredibly important economic considerations here, which is why China's done this week.
And, you know, you mentioned the fact that millions of women have missed out on the chance to have more than one child. Do you think women now in China are going to take up the offer and opportunity, or do you think there's a bit more complicated than that?
Yeah, absolutely, John. It's a really good question, because I was going through Weibo this week just to see what people were saying about it, and I was surprised at how much frustration and anger there was, not just at the original one-child policy, but also at the three-child policy now, because they're saying, how do you expect us to have three children in this current system? So school fees are incredibly high. People might not know that a third of Chinese students are privately educated, because the state sector is actually surprisingly small in that regard. You've also got very middle-class concerns about extra tuition, the stress levels of having one child already really high, and the cost of living from housing to work life are very high as well. And so people are complaining or taking to social media to complain, we can't have more than one child anyway, we don't want to do that. And for women as well, you know, they're educated now, motherhood is not the be-all and end-all of modern life for them. And so there was backlash to the Chinese Communist Party on that front as well. So I don't think this policy is actually going to do what they want to do, which is to rejuvenate the population.
And James, from the economic front, I mean, we've heard for years how China's the sort of growing economic juggernaut. It can't be stopped, almost. It's going to exaggerate slightly, it's going to take over the world. It's quite interesting, isn't it? It's quite a big structural problem that the Chinese state has. I mean, we've got aging populations here, but it just seems on a different level, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think as Cindy says in the piece, it's the speed with which China moved from raising the limit to two children to three children is telling of the size of the problem. The speed at which this change from two to three has come about suggests that the lift of the cap to two has not had the desired effect in terms of the demographics. I think one of the most difficult questions about China is China as strong as it appears? And I think last year there was a lot of kind of pessimism in the West about, you know, who the future belonged to. Because, yes, COVID might have started in China, but for a kind of combination, a kind of marriage of brutality and technological competence, China appeared to be stamping the virus out while the West was really struggling, you know, Cindy wrote that piece about, you know, pool parties in Wuhan while the West was still labouring under restrictions. I think some of that has eroded in that the vaccines, I mean, have given the West back some of its intellectual self-confidence, especially given that the Chinese-developed vaccines do not seem to be as effective. And I also think that Trump leaving the White House, President Biden coming in, has made it easier to kind of to begin to pull together Western alliances. And I think China has misstepped, right? So, for example, the EU, much to the chagrin of the incoming Biden administration, signed an investment treaty with China just before Biden took office. And I think that was quite an effective kind of wedge-driving tactic by Beijing. But they then completely undermined that by sanctioning a bunch of members of the European Parliament, which now means that there's very little chance of that treaty being ratified. I thought the Xi speech this week was a sign that, you know, to my mind, struck me as a recognition that some of this wolf warrior diplomacy has actually rebounded on China. But there are still elements that, you know, China is still so linked into the world economy. And I think one of the interesting things is that you are not, despite the various flare-ups you've had about, you know, the use of forced labour in China and like, you're not seeing Western companies disengage. You know, some data out this week showed that Apple's dependence on its Chinese suppliers is actually intensifying, rather than Apple trying to wean itself off and find alternative supply options.
And investment banks like Goldman Sachs are increasing their China operations because China's actually liberalised finance in that way. So there's a bit of salami tactics going on where, you know, politically speaking, relations are pretty bad at the moment, but China's opening the door to businesses in a way that's giving them a carrot, which, you know, obviously undermines any united Western societal response.
And on the sort of Western preoccupations point, isn't it? I thought it was really bit interesting bit in your piece where you mentioned, I think it was the Washington Post actually supported the one-child policy back in the day. Do you think there's sort of been a overarching Western anxiety about China for a long time? And do you think there's been a bit too much hand-wringing almost about these sort of demographic worries?
Yeah, I think one thing that James, in his political column for The Spectator, writes so well in this week is just that, you know, the West has never understood China, and we still don't have a good starting point for dealing with China because we just don't understand China. You know, when that Washington Post thing is absolutely incredible, and it just betrays how similar the West and China can be in some respects, but also how flimsy demographic science can be as well. But even today, we don't really understand what China is about. And I would say that in reverse, China doesn't understand about the West either. You know, on this EU investment bill, what's interesting is that the Chinese reporting all still think it's going to go ahead. They still think that Germany and France will pull rank and just direct the rest of the EU to ratify this deal, because they have this idea of international relations as completely being, values don't have any place in it, it's completely results driven, and France and Germany are the adults in the room, in quotation marks. So they think, I mean, they might be right, I don't know, but they still very much don't think that they shot themselves in the foot.
I think one of the big differences, I mean, we talk a lot about the comparisons between the Soviet Union and China, is I think that one of the big differences is, if this was 1970 in this office, and you could walk out onto the street and you could bump into, you know, almost every sixth person you bumped into, civil servant, would be a Sovietologist who could tell you who in the Politburo had which views, who were reformers, who were not reformers. You know, we don't have any of that information about China. And I mean, one of the things that the West really struggles with is Xi clearly represents a shift in direction in Chinese policy. To a more openly confrontational stance. And all the peaceful rise stuff has kind of gone out the window. And I think one of the interesting things is the West is very uncertain. Even the people who, you know, the China experts who are advising government are very uncertain about how much this is a permanent shift, how much it's never going back, or whether Xi, maybe after Xi there'll be a correction back towards a different course or not. I mean, that is going to be an increasing problem, because as Cindy said, you know, there are ways in which China doesn't understand the West, and there are ways in which the West doesn't understand China. And not to bring every conversation back to Taiwan, I mean, that does create a danger of miscalculation here, which is, you know, how do you get to a place where the risk of this miscalculation across, you know, the strait, that China thinking that, you know, the West would or wouldn't act in response if something happened. And, you know, there is an interesting debate. The Biden administration has kind of kept going with the Trump administration of kind of policy of not recognizing Taiwan as a state, but greater recognition of Taiwan as an entity, to put it like that. And I think there is an intense debate in Washington about whether this is the best way to deter an attack on Taiwan, because you are suggesting to Beijing that you would be prepared to fight to defend Taiwan, or actually, is this a massive mistake? Because the thing that would tip China into action was a belief that Taiwanese independence or right to self-determination might be recognised. And I mean, this, I think, one of the dangers is the lack of mutual comprehension creates a greater risk of miscalculation.
And if we're looking at topics where China and the West definitely don't see eye to eye, it's probably the topic of your column this week, James, which is the sort of growing plausibility of the Wuhan lab leak theory. And where does the West go from here? I mean, I think you mentioned in your column, it's very difficult to prove that this definitely happened. But if there is a sort of growing acceptance that the coronavirus did leak from a Wuhan lab, how does the West respond to that?
I think one of the interesting things is that in the last few weeks, that far more people in Westminster and Whitehall, you know, the lab leak was previously quite a fringe theory. Now it has become kind of increasingly mainstream in its thinking. But everyone you talk to who thinks that maybe it did leak from a lab, and I think it's worth stressing here that everyone thinks it leaked from a lab accidentally, no one thinks this was a kind of deliberate act, doesn't really have any idea about what you do in response. You know, Trump used to talk about reparations. The fact is, no Western government wants to open up any kind of reparations debate because, you know, to quote Ernie Bevin, you open that Pandora's box, you don't know what Trojan horses come out. You know, I think the UK would be rather exposed in a debate about reparations, as would the, you know, so that's not going to happen. I am sceptical on sanctions. I think that you probably would likely get some kind of international lab research standards with an argument that, you know, if China won't accept international inspections, you know, you essentially put a kind of research embargo on China. But I think one of the other things about this is that the lab leak also shows something else, which is there has been a tendency by Western governments and companies to kind of outsource particularly risky research that might be just difficult to justify to a domestic audience to China, because China has a more permissive approach to these things. I think what this shows, and the lack of certainty about whether it did or didn't leak from a lab, shows is the risk in this, because the Achilles heel of all authoritarian regimes is that they cannot omit error, so that things get covered up rather than problems dealt with. And I was talking to someone in government about the lab leak theory, and they said, look, you know, this could have happened to any of us. But the difference is, would it have been covered up if this had happened in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Cambridge in England, rather than in Wuhan? And that I think, is the tension.
And Cindy, do you think China are worried about the lab leak theory, or do you think they can sort of ride this one out a bit?
Well, they're doing their best, aren't they? I think they are concerned, and as James pointed out in his piece, that explains to some extent the ferocity with which they came back at the Australia call for an independent inquiry. Not because they necessarily, you know, if there was a cover-up, I can imagine there was a cover-up at some middling level. I don't think this necessarily has to go all the way up to Xi Jinping for it to be a cover-up, just because of the way they're structured, right? In Chernobyl, people were lower down covered up until they couldn't anymore. But, you know, China does not want to wear what we call in Chinese the black wok on your back. You know, it doesn't want to be the scapegoat for this, and it will do whatever it takes in order to shift blame. And you can see that, you know, even after WHO's inquiry is like, oh, well, we welcome the WHO coming to China now, and we would welcome other countries like America to welcome the WHO inquiry to go into theirs too, because they're still peddling this theory that it came from the American military. Well, at least some people there are. So I think it is concern, and the backlash will be quite severe. I agree with James that, you know, we wouldn't know what to do, but I think China is still keen to at least not be seen as a pariah state. And it's also just going to be embarrassing, because it wants to pride itself on a scientific country. It wants to pride itself on having that prowess, which is explains Made in China 2025 as an industrial strategy. So it's embarrassing, you know, if you've caused a global pandemic. It's humiliating. And the Chinese people, you know, could create legitimacy problems for the CCP as well. But the plausible deniability is what saves it, right? Because we'll never know. And so it's always going to be he said, she said, I think.
Thank you, Cindy. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And please do remember to rate, review, and subscribe to the Coffee House Shop podcast. We'll be back next week.